This is special coverage of the presidential inauguration from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Barack Obama took the oath of office with his hand on Abraham Lincoln's Bible, quoted George Washington, and then called on the nation to remake America.
With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
More than a million gathered on the National Mall to witness history. We'll check in with some of them this hour. We'll get reaction to the new president's remarks from Baghdad. We'll hear a bit later from news analyst Ted Koppel, and in just a moment from NPR political editor Ken Rudin. And we'll watch out for the start of the inaugural parade down Pennsylvania Avenue and throughout. We want to hear from you. Washington, D.C. may have been brought to a standstill by today's events, but this is a working day in the rest of the country. Where did you listen to President Obama's inaugural speech? How will you mark this day? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Ken Rudin, political editor for NPR, joins us here in the studio. Good afternoon, Ken.
Hi, Neil.
And for political junkies, it's hard to remember just a year and 17 days since the Iowa caucuses.
Exactly. Matter of fact, I was on the Metro this morning, and there was a woman wearing exactly that, a button that said it all began in Iowa. She took a bus from Des Moines. She was there with her family and some other friends from Iowa, and very proud. They believe they really started it back in January of 2008.
And it really felt like more than a transition from one party to another. Well, it had reminiscences of President Kennedy, the torch being passed into a new generation, and to, well, so many presidents have said, well, now it's time for all of us to work together under my agenda.
This was, I agree with you, this was completely different. The tone was different. And even if Barack Obama did not have a speech that one will remember as one of the greatest inaugural addresses of all time, and you always think of Roosevelt's in, you know, in 33 and Kennedy in 61 and Reagan in 81, the history, you just couldn't ignore what was involved here. As you say, John F. Kennedy being sworn in 1961, the youngest ever elected president following Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was much older, of course. But there was something about Barack Obama, an African-American, given the fact that, as he said in his speech 60 years ago, his father wouldn't even be able to eat or, you know, attend a restaurant.
Would not have been served
in a restaurant in Washington, D.C. And on the Metro this morning, I just saw a lot of elderly women, a lot of African-American women, and I would have loved to have just known what they were thinking, because there were so many tears, there were a lot of cheers and a chance of Obama on the train. Usually, you know, you don't say anything on the train except, you know, get out of my way, please, or not even please.
Not even please, so
exactly.
Often, yeah.
But there was just so much history, not so much in watching Obama, but watching the people anticipate what Obama had to say, and that was pretty remarkable.
Washington, D.C., a city that likes to think of itself as the hub of the universe almost every day. Well, today, it indeed was the center of everybody's attention.
And not only, and you know, in previous inaugural addresses, you know that the president, the new president, will be talking to the folks who voted for him and who did not vote for him. But here, clearly, Barack Obama was talking to the whole world. The whole world, you know, whatever they felt about the last 8 years, they knew what they had invested in a new president in Barack Obama. And I think that that address was seen, obviously, worldwide and felt worldwide.
After the address, the presidential party retreated from the stage there on the west front of the Capitol. When inside, President Obama accompanied former President George W. Bush to a helicopter that took him one last trip over the White House, then over the Potomac River and out to Andrews Air Force Base. He is on his way back to Texas. Then President Obama signed some pieces of paper that formally, officially designated his cabinet appointments, so Congress can get to work on confirming some of those nominations. That should begin this afternoon, about 3 o'clock, we're told. And then the president, as is traditional, sat down to lunch with some of the leaders of Congress in Statuary Hall. And shortly, he will begin leading the parade down Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol to the White House. He'll be, of course, at a reviewing stand for much of the afternoon watching this grand parade. NPR's Linda Wertheimer is along that route at the Canadian Embassy. Linda, are you there?
I am.
And what's the atmosphere there like on Pennsylvania Avenue as people wait for this parade to get underway?
Well, everybody's sort of staking out their area. You can see down on the street that people are looking for anything that they can stand on, which will give them a better view. The crowd has been very patient, especially, you know, we're just waiting for those moments of sunshine, waiting for opportunities to hear something from the mall during the course of the speech and whatnot. But now the crowd is getting larger as people come off the mall and pull up here on Pennsylvania Avenue to watch the speech. I mean, to watch the parade. There's some 90 bands in this parade, so it's going to be a very long one. And we're very beautifully situated to watch it right here at the Canadian Embassy, where not only is there a good vantage point from the sort of the rotunda kind of portico that they have built out in front of the embassy, but also they're serving beaver tail soup.
Well, then you're in excellent position, and it's nice to hear that you're being fortified. How cold is it? I know it was quite chilly this morning.
It's very cold, but the sun keeps coming out, and there are patches of blue in the sky, so I think that the weather, although, you know, if you stand still for a long period of time, it's a little frightening, it's not terrible. This is a cold winter day, but it's not as bad as, remember when they canceled the second Reagan inaugural because it was snowing sideways and it was dark, like it was, you know, night on the mall, and Mrs. Reagan said, Poppy is not going out in that. That's not happening. And they canceled the whole thing. This is just merely winter.
Linda, we will be checking back with you throughout the afternoon as the parade approaches. Thanks very much. Stay warm.
Thank you.
Joining us now, NPR reporter Andrea Seabrook. And Andrea, you're also along the parade route on Pennsylvania Avenue. What's the scene like where you are?
Yes, I am. I am at Freedom Plaza, which is a little closer to the White House, but right on the route between the White House and the Capitol. And over the last, hour and a half, we've seen a buildup of security along the parade route. There is still a crush of people outside of the security perimeter, people trying to get in and get a chance to see the parade go by. But along the route, inside that perimeter, there are soldiers, Marines, Navy people, police of all different kinds, National Guard, three and four people deep guarding the perimeter. We've also seen buses come from the Capitol back towards the White House. We can only assume that there are dignitaries and members of Congress in those buses coming back towards the White House. But the feeling in the air, though, here is really exciting. I mean, everybody is cold, but they're also dancing to keep warm. We've got music going, and it's a party out here.
It's difficult to keep it. Some of those people, I assume, have been there for some hours gathering in place.
Oh, yes. There are people here who have been here since, 6 in the morning. So while there are people moving off the National Mall because they saw the inauguration, the people here, they're not moving. They're protecting their real estate for this, the parade that should come, start happening about 15 minutes.
Or so, but it's going to take a while even to get to you. So
we'll
be checking back with you, Andrea, as well. Thanks very much.
Great. Talk to you later.
And we want to hear from those of you listening as well. Where did you watch the speech today? Of course, Washington, D.C., the town has virtually come to a standstill. Those people shivering, too, because they'd like to be moving around. Where did you watch the speech, and how will you mark the day? 800-989-8255. Email us. talk@npr.org. We'll begin with John. John with us from St. Louis.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I was watching from my desk via the internet, actually listening to your broadcast while some layoffs were going on around the office.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was certainly unfortunate. A lot of mixed emotions. I mean, people want to be happy, but, of course, seeing their friends pack up their belongings is a big deal.
What kind of business are you in?
I work for a media company in St. Louis.
And was this the first round of layoffs?
Actually, no. It's been pretty bad these last couple months. So.
And is this something you fear is going to continue?
I hope not, but I would imagine that I think this is probably our biggest cut, and hopefully things will start to get better in the coming months. But Probably not.
And John, I have to ask, are you among those packing up your things?
I am not. I was actually talking to my boss, and she was telling me how she was upset. She had to, while Obama was speaking, she was having to lay someone off at that very moment. So it was very depressing. But no, luckily, I still have a job for now.
John, thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Chris. Chris in Cleveland.
Yes. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was at my children's elementary school. I have two that are there, and I took our three-year-old son there, and we were in the auditorium, and they had a big screen set up, and all the kids were there in the classes, and it was very, very exciting. They were very full of enthusiasm, especially when they showed Sasha and Malia on the screen, and all the kids started to cheer and clap. It was really an emotional experience.
Did they sit and pay attention as the new president spoke?
You know, that was towards the end. The kids had gotten there about around 11:30, so they were getting a little squirrely, but most of the older kids, second and third and above, were all kind of intently listening, and I would say that they were all very well behaved and interested.
And how did they like the musical performances, Aretha Franklin and, that wonderful quartet of classical musicians?
You know, it's funny. My son is a violin player, and so I was looking at him, and he was very much interested. And me being a musician myself, I loved both Aretha and the quartet. So.
And as you looked around on that crowd, there are people who in 30, 40 years' time could be there on the mall themselves.
Definitely. That's what the principal said. She said, boys and girls, this could be you in 40 or 50 years. This could be you.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. We're listening to you, and we're also listening to NPR political editor Ken Rudin. When we get back, we'll check in with Baghdad to hear reaction to President Obama's inaugural address there. We'll also speak with NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage of the inaugural day. This is NPR News. This is special coverage of the presidential inauguration from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At this point, President Obama is likely on his way back to the U.S. Capitol. He and Vice President Joe Biden are scheduled to review the troops at the east front of the Capitol in about 10 minutes' time. From there, they leave for the parade route down Pennsylvania Avenue. The day's events will last well into tonight. Where did you listen to President Obama's inauguration, and how will you mark the day? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. In his inaugural address, the president laid out some of his foreign policy goals.
We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we will work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you.
Barack Obama, moments after he was sworn in as the 44th president of the United States. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel. But let's go now to Baghdad and NPR Baghdad bureau chief Lourdes Garcia Navarro. Lourdes, good afternoon, Washington time. Good evening where you are.
Exactly. Good evening.
And was President Obama's speech broadcast there in Baghdad?
It certainly was. Many of the Iraqi satellite channels broadcast it live, and many of the people that I spoke to watched it as it was being broadcast live. As you can imagine, a great deal of interest here in Iraq about what the President of the United States will now be doing here. There are 140,000 U.S. troops still stationed here, and you know, the next few months and the next few years will be very critical for Iraq, and they're wondering exactly what President Obama will do here.
One of the few specifics in his address today was, in fact, a promise, the promise that he made continually through the campaign to begin to withdraw responsibly from Iraq soon. He did not specify the amount of time, but everything we're hearing is something on the order of 16 months, which is quicker than called for in the recently ratified Status of Forces Agreement.
That's exactly right. I've been speaking to Iraqis over the last few days about President Obama and about his plan to withdraw Iraqi forces from here. And it's very interesting. You know, you go out into the streets, you talk to people, and there are such mixed emotions about the U.S. presence here, about the plans to withdraw forces. You speak to Iraqis, and they do feel that they are under occupation. They do feel that the presence of U.S. forces here is a humiliation and a blight on their sovereignty and on their sense of national pride. But they are split on what they want. Some Iraqis telling me that they'd like to see the back of U.S. troops tomorrow, if not today. Some Iraqis saying, you know, we didn't ask for this invasion. America came here. They broke it. They have to stay until it's fixed. We still don't feel that this country's stable. We still don't feel that the Iraqi security forces are able to rise to the challenge in case there's further conflict. So we need them to stay a little bit longer. So Iraqis themselves are divided on what they want.
Though he had some strong words of warning for terrorists, as we just heard, we say to you now, our spirit is stronger, cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us. We will defeat you. At the same time, he also specifically addressed Muslims, saying, quote, to the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect. Any reaction to that?
Yeah, I spoke to Sheikh Jalaluddin Al-Sagar. He's a religious cleric and a senior member of the governing Shiite coalition here. And, you know, he had something very interesting to say. He said, we want to hear this. This is a change in tone. It's very important that this that there is a change in tone in the discourse with the Muslim world. Over the past 5 to 6 years, we felt that we have been targeted. We've been called terrorists. And now, you know, we'd like to have a better relationship. But by the same time, by the same token, there is a great deal of anger throughout the Muslim world. We just saw the recent events in Israel and Gaza, you know, the Iraq war, Afghanistan. There are still many conflicts going throughout this area. And so pretty much across the board, what people are saying is we have to wait and see practically what steps are taken here.
How will this be different, if at all?
How will this be different, if at all? And, you know, many Iraqis do express some skepticism when you talk to them. They say, I really don't know what a President Obama can do differently. I really don't believe that U.S. forces will be fully withdrawn from this country. They believe that American forces, some people believe that they came here for oil. And so they treat it with a lot of skepticism when they think that American troops would fully withdraw from Iraq and not one U.S. soldier would remain here. They just don't believe that that is ever going to be the case.
And any
any
reaction to the departure today of George W. Bush, the man who launched the invasion of Iraq?
Well, he's not a popular man here, as you can imagine. I mean, if you remember, President Bush came here on his last visit, and he was, a shoe was thrown at him at a press conference. And pretty much that was viewed, you know, favorably by many Iraqis that I spoke to. His departure, many people, you know, won't miss him, quite frankly. And many people here do believe that, and they're hoping that President Obama will, you know, engage in a different way with Iraqis and will treat them with more respect. As I said before, you know, Iraqis really do feel that they've been humiliated. And not only that, you've got to remember that the cost in blood of this war, the tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands who've died here, throughout the course of the last 6 years, any Iraqi that you speak to on the street will tell you, and I asked them this question, was the war worth it for you? Did this invasion, do you feel, give you a better life? And across the board, I didn't find one Iraqi who said to me, actually, I'm glad this happened. Most Iraqis have paid the price of, you know, if you want to call it their freedom, in blood, the blood of their relatives. So it's still a very painful issue for them. And they're very much looking forward to seeing what's going to happen next, what the United States will do here, and how President Obama will act differently than his predecessor, President Bush.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
NPR's Baghdad bureau chief, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, speaking with us live from Baghdad. Well, let's go now to NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel, who listened to today's events at his home in Maryland. Ted, nice to talk with you.
And it's nice to be with you, Neil. May I just say something first before we get into all these nasty, tough issues that confront our new president? I wasn't born in this country. I was born in England, and I'm an American citizen by choice, not by accident of birth. And I just want to say, every time that I see one of these inaugurations, it is just such a uniquely American ceremony and such a wonderful thing to observe. And you have to, I mean, you can't avoid, particularly when you have two men like George Bush and Barack Obama, who clearly have made an effort that this transition goes smoothly. When they embrace each other on the steps of the Capitol as they did, you can just see what's passing between the two of them. There's not much they agree on, perhaps, but they do understand what great responsibility is being passed from one man to the other.
Yeah, that moment that George W. Bush talked about, he said it descended upon him when he entered the Oval Office for the first time as president. Barack Obama has yet to do that, so perhaps the moment will descend on him there. Nevertheless, it cannot have been an easy speech for George W. Bush to listen to as he sat behind Barack Obama and listened to him say, the time has come to put away childish things.
Well, most especially when, I mean, there is a line that precedes by a couple of paragraphs, the one that you played a moment ago, Neil, where President Obama said, "As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals." Now, who do you think he was talking about there? Clearly, the previous administration, George Bush, Dick Cheney, who seemed to be saying at times, I mean, they never would have rejected American ideals, but who seemed to be saying, you guys are naive, you don't understand the difficulty of what confronts us, the dangers that confront us, the enormity of some of those dangers. What if those terrorists on 9/11 had been carrying weapons of mass destruction? And therefore, you're going to find for yourself that it's not going to be as easy as these noble phrases make it sound. And there was, as you probably remember, Neil, an interesting exchange between the new president and Dick Cheney several days ago. And I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not going to get this exactly right. But the essence of it was that Dick Cheney said to Barack Obama, "Be a little bit careful. You don't want to be making too many harsh comments about what we did and how we did it until you have been fully briefed and realize the enormity of some of the dangers that confront you." And when Barack Obama was asked about that, he said, someone said to him, "What did you think?" And he said, "I thought it was prudent advice." He is not a foolish man, Barack Obama. He understands that the challenges that confront him now are going to make some of these high-flown speeches seem almost quaint in a few months. He still faces all of the same problems that George Bush faced. Will there be a difference in tone? You bet. There already is. Will there be a difference in terms of tactics? Very likely. Is the ultimate strategy going to change? I would be surprised.
Ted Koppel, thanks very much for being with us today. We thank you for your time, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel with us from his home in Maryland, where he watched President Obama's speech and the events on the Capitol Hill today. Let's go now to Scott Horsley, who is about to board a flatbed truck and precede the new president down Pennsylvania Avenue. Scott, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Neil. And boy, when you talk about a change of tone, I think we're going to experience one in just a moment here. It was, as you say, a fairly somber speech that the new president delivered on the steps of the Capitol. But there is also a great air of celebration here in Washington, and I think that's going to be captured by this parade, this mile-and-a-half parade that we're about to embark on.
And let's see what's going to happen, and where is the new president right now?
Well, he is inside the Capitol, and we are on a street just alongside the north end of the Capitol, getting set to travel down Pennsylvania Avenue, the mile and a half, to the White House. Traditionally, the new president will walk some part of that distance, and we believe that Barack Obama will walk, but he'll also travel part of the distance in his new presidential limousine with the number one on the license plate. And just behind the presidential contingent, there'll be some representatives from the armed services, and then marching bands and representatives from all 50 states. Close to the front of the pack will be the junior ROTC and the high school marching band from Punahou High School in Hawaii, the new president's alma mater. And I dare say the temperature here in Washington is going to be something of a shock to the woodwind players in the Punahou marching band.
Yes, indeed. I think it's going to come to a shock to them all. Scott, we will be checking back with you throughout the day as that parade gets underway, and you can tell us what's going on.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Stay warm, Scott. Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A. Ken?
I was just thinking about what Ted Koppel just said about how, you know, the very American event as the inauguration and the transfer of power. It's also very American that we run out of patience very early in. And right now, as the enormity, the amount of problems that are on Barack Obama's desk is just, you know, piled sky high. I think the popular his approval ratings, or at least people wanting him to succeed, is also enormous. But I just wonder how long people will have the patience, because, yes, there may be a withdrawal schedule from Iraq, but so far there's no solving of what's going on in Gaza. There's no solving what's going on in Afghanistan. In fact, Barack Obama is talking about more troops, tens of thousands of more troops in Afghanistan. So as the problems go on, I just wonder how long the American patience will go on as well.
Let's talk with listeners about where they were listening to today's events and how they're going to mark the day. Let's go next to Daniel. Daniel with us from Miami.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, good. My experience was quite painful, actually. I was in my dentist's office this morning, and we were running late. So I was in the middle of a root canal in agonizing pain, and apparently the office I was in was the only one that had a TV in it. And although I couldn't lift my head up or even see straight from the pain, the rest of the office staff was in the room and all watching in the inauguration speech and getting teary-eyed. But my main concern is, similar to the movie Clockwork Orange, I'm afraid now every time I hear Mr. Obama's voice that I may revert back to the agonizing pain that I was dealing with.
So the Pavlovian response to the new president's words being uttered on television are going to be a stabbing pain in your gums.
I certainly hope not, because I voted for him, and I'm excited about where America's headed. But the pain, she wasn't focusing as much as she should have at the task at hand, but rather at what he was saying. And my mouth is still sore, to say the least.
Daniel, we hope you feel better.
I do, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to this is Sandy. Sandy with us from Tucson in Arizona.
Hi, this is Sarity, actually.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I went with my mother to Centennial Hall at the University of Arizona, and she and I had been racing around to make sure we got there on time, parked, and actually got a $50 ticket, but nevertheless, we got there and we embraced each other, tears rolling down our eyes, and my mother has been a long advocate of civil rights. I mean, when I was in school, she let me go to a Rosa Parks event when it was MLK Day, before that was nationally recognized, and this has been a long time coming. She's a major supporter. And in the lobby after the speech, she screamed out loud in the middle of 100 people at least, "We did it!" And everyone started cheering, and I said, "That's my mom."
How many people were there at Centennial Hall?
Oh, probably somewhere around 400, I would guess, or 500. I wasn't sure, but and, it was a wonderful event. We did lots of standing ovations. We stood up every time, and we were really like we were there on the mall with them. It was beautiful.
Sarah D., thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
So bye-bye. And let's go now to Bill. Bill with us from Juneau in Alaska. Bill, you there?
Hello. Are you there?
We're right here, Bill. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
One of our favorite local ladies, Cheryl Richardson, had rented two-thirds of our convention center, also called Centennial Hall, for breakfast with the president. Of course, everything started at 7:15 in the morning here. The local coffee company, Heritage Coffee, donated Obama Blend, which is, of course, half Kenyan, half Kona coffee.
Huh.
And by the time the swearing-in was over, they had dispensed 2,000 cups and were going for more. Now, this is a town of 30,000 people. We're the capital city, and there are a few hundred extra here because the legislature is about to gear up.
Was the governor there?
No, we didn't see her. I assume she's on duty because the legislature commences today.
And
it was a fantastic flag-waving gang of folks, including preschoolers, the Montessori, and a bunch of other kids sitting on the floor and standing all around. It was jam-packed.
Bill, thanks very much. I hope you had a good day.
Thank you, sir.
So long. And Ken Rudin, we talked about the spirit of comedy that noted the transition, and Barack Obama mentioned it the first line of his speech today. There was a moment when Vice President Cheney was introduced as he came out in a wheelchair. He had his bad back from moving boxes, where there were some boos from the crowd.
And there were some boos when President Bush's picture was on the Jumbotron. People in the crowd watching booed as well. It was... I mean, it's democracy at its finest, although you'd like to think that on a day like this, there would not be that kind of feeling. But, you know, there were a lot of pent-up emotions over the last 8 years, starting from the election of 2000 itself. So perhaps it's a new era right now.
Ken Rudin, stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the Tuskegee Airmen who was not able to make it to Washington today. They, as a group, were invited among other civil rights pioneers, and more of your calls. Where did you watch the president's speech today? How are you going to mark the day? 800-989-8255 or email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage of the presidential inauguration from NPR News. This is special coverage of the presidential inauguration from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And here are headlines from some stories we're following here today at NPR News. Italian carmaker Fiat and automaker Chrysler say they've agreed to form a strategic alliance that would give Fiat a 35% stake in the troubled U.S. carmaker. The deal would give Chrysler access to new markets. And U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon toured Israel and Gaza today in the wake of the Israeli military action in the Gaza Strip. Ban promised aid for the Palestinians and expressed disappointment that he could not bring an end to the fighting sooner. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Any moment now, we expect the inaugural parade to get underway in Washington, D.C. We have reporters stationed up down Pennsylvania Avenue. We'll check in with them shortly. NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is with us here in the studio. And Ken, some interesting stumbles in the ceremony today. First, with the oath of office, Chief Justice John Roberts was reciting the oath of office, repeat after me, and well, then Barack Obama stopped and waited as if he'd forgotten something.
Exactly. He, Chief Justice Roberts used the word, he said that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, but he didn't say faithfully. He used faithfully at the end, so that kind of threw Barack Obama off. Now, as you well remember, in 2005, Barack Obama voted against confirming John Roberts as Chief Justice, so perhaps he was trying to get him back at him or something.
Could have been.
It was a very unusual thing, and I think Obama played it fine.
But everybody was smiling and laughing about it.
But it was something to watch.
But the first president to be sworn in by Chief Justice whom he had voted against.
That's exactly right. It reminds a lot of people, Richard Nixon and Earl Warren, when Earl Warren swore in Richard Nixon in 1969, they hated each other, going back to 1952.
Both from California,
both
of course.
Both California Republicans, and yet Earl Warren, and as a matter of fact, when Richard Nixon was elected in 68, he campaigned against the Warren Court, the liberalism of the Warren Court. It was interesting to see Warren and Nixon together at the platform in 69. Obviously, the relationship between Roberts and Obama is much more cordial.
And NPR's political junkie noticed another error in the president's
Error. In the second paragraph of Barack Obama's speech, he said 44 Americans have now taken the presidential oath. He was incorrect. It's only 43 because, as you well remember, Grover Cleveland was both the 22nd and the 24th president. So even though Barack Obama is the 44th president, he is the 43rd man. I know you weren't expecting math to be part of this, but he is the 43rd.
Your strong suit, yeah, arithmetic.
Yes, exactly.
joining us now on the phone is Hiram Mann. He flew in the Second World War as one of the Tuskegee Airmen, America's first black military pilots. President Obama acknowledged his debt to that group and invited the airmen to participate in today's inaugural events. Hiram, though, watched the ceremonies from his home in Florida. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let me toss in something. I want to go back to what you were saying about that swearing in. I, too, noticed that. And a third opinion, I thought Obama was waiting for Chief Justice to correct himself.
I think you're right about that.
That's what I thought. Okay, now, your question.
My question is, well, first of all, why weren't you here in Washington today?
I'm not physically able. I use a wheelchair occasionally. Now, I want to clarify that for... I was interviewed December 12th by one of the staff writers from the Washington Post, and she told me, asked me, would I participate? And I told her, no, I wouldn't be caught standing in that mall at lengthy time and walk trying to walk the distance that they were going to have to walk because of my occasional use of a wheelchair. And when she printed it, it went, I don't know whether it was IP or AP, but I had calls from California and various other places. Friends of mine wanted to know what was the matter with my health. Well, I'm not intrepid, or decrepit, rather, to the point that I rely on the wheelchair, but just that mob of people that was there. That's why I stayed home and watched it from the comfort of my living room, and as I manned two VCRs, trying to get it from get the whole thing, various different opinions and all that.
And I have to ask you, years ago when you were in the Tuskegee Airmen, I assume you flew a P-51?
I flew the 50. I was a fighter pilot, correct. I flew other fighters also.
Well, as a lot of people never thought they would see an African-American, a black pilot, at the controls of a P-51. And, of course, I wonder that day, as you flew into the air for the first time in combat for the United States of America, if you thought you would live to see the day that an African-American was sworn in as President of the United States, as the Commander-in-Chief.
Back farther than that. I remember all of my schooling was in integrated situations. And I remember in upper elementary school, one of my young, white, female teachers, and I don't know what, it was 1920, but I remember distinctly that she had said any male American citizen could be president of the United States. And I went for years in my naivete thinking that I, too, could be president of the United States. And after I became a teenager and later teenager, I recognized the subtleties of discrimination and segregation in the northern states as well as the overt discrimination and segregation in the southern states. The north was sneaky with the way they did it. At amusement parks, we stood in one line, black and white together, and then at the skating pavilion, you stand outside and watch the people enjoy the skating. And I noticed no blacks. We were Negroes and colored at that time.
Mm-hmm.
There were never any colored in the skating rink or the dancing pavilion. They were older people. But I understand that when Negroes attempted to go into pay the fee or whatever it was to go to the skating rink, they were told you had to be a member of the club in order to get in. But I didn't have any money to go in anyway, so it didn't bother me. I stood outside and watched the people enjoy it, and I vicariously enjoyed it with them.
So in your lifetime, you saw the military integrated?
I've seen change definitely, the military. It took me three attempts to get into the flying training program. I attempted to get in before, in the late 1940s, in early 41. I wanted to fly. I married in September 1940, and I got the bright eye. I anticipated America was going to get into the war, and I didn't want my wife, my bride, my mother, my grandmother, subjected to what the women in Europe were going through with the Nazis and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to volunteer to fly for my country. My wife didn't want me to do it, of course, but I wrote a letter to the War Department. I don't remember what I said in that letter, but the first letter of rejection that I received said in no uncertain terms there were no facilities to train Negroes to fly in any branch of the American military service. That ticked me off, I euphemize. I boiled the letter up, threw it away. I went back to my regular job. And then later I heard that, Yeah, that's correct. Later I heard that they were going to start this school specifically to train Negroes to fly. And I applied the second time. I wrote a letter the second time. And that letter of rejection, which I have a copy of, it said, for anyone to get into a flying training program, they must have completed at that time. I did not know when I applied the first time that all American pilots had to be college graduates and they had to be single. But the second letter of rejection said for anyone to get into a American flying training program, they must be single and they must have completed a minimum of 2 years of college at that time.
Well, we're glad that the third time was the charm, and we wish you could have been with us here in Washington today.
I was with you in spirit.
Hiram Mann, thank you so much for being with us in spirit today.
I saw several of my buddies on the shots from of the Tuskegee Airmen that were there, and I was there, but I wasn't there.
Well, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Have a good one. Will I be able to get a copy of this?
Absolutely. On two VCRs.
To who?
On two VCRs. We're going to put you on hold and get your information where we can send it to you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. We're going to go now to David Wellner. David Wellner is up on Capitol Hill. We're going to be going to him shortly. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go instead to Thomas. Thomas with us from Louisville in Kentucky.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good to hear. It was a very exciting day for me.
Where were you?
Well, I was actually at the doctor's office getting, with me and my fiance, getting our very first ultrasound. So during the inauguration, I got to hear my baby's heartbeat for the first time and see her first pictures.
So she will always be associated with you in your mind with the inauguration.
Most definitely. And then they told us how far along we were, which is 11 weeks, which dates right to Election Day.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kooky how it all worked out, but, you know, who knows? It might be the next president in the making.
And have you decided on a name for the baby yet?
We've got a couple different ones that we're kind of leaning towards, but we don't know whether it's a boy or girl. So, actually, what was kind of crazy is I'm not for sure of... I think it's Sasha, which is Obama's daughter.
Yes.
My fiance really likes that name, so they're thinking of Sasha Grace.
Well, that might be appropriate.
So.
All right. Thomas, we wish you and your wife and the baby the best of luck.
Well, thank you very much. You guys have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go now to, this is Mark. Mark with us from Hinesburg in Vermont.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was fortunate to watch the inauguration with my wife in my home. The really intense part was that also my son, who is 13, is down for a junior leadership conference, and he was on the mall after having spent a few days there in a conference before the inauguration. So it was an amazing experience to be so far from my son and so proud of him for being a part of this conference and yet being so happy to be part of a country again. That is inspiring. I've lost that in the last few years, and it felt really wonderful to be in that place again.
And were there people around you as you watched?
Yes, my wife and another one of my younger children were around, and we were just absorbed in his speech, but we kept trying to call our son, who the cell phones weren't working, so we couldn't be in touch with him, who was, I'm sure, just beside himself with excitement being there as a part of it.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much. We're going to have to cut you off to go now to President Obama.
And the teamwork and the good spirits that went into it. And I want to thank our military and our law enforcement officers, the City of Washington and Mayor Fenty, the devoted staff and volunteers, including our wait staff here today who were putting up with me wandering through the tables.
President Obama speaking at the luncheon in Statuary Hall.
It's always hazardous duty serving in a room full of politicians. But I thank all of you for just a incredible, incredible event. This has been a historic inauguration that's been noted before. You see it not so much in this room, although this is a gathering of some of my best friends and my family and people with extraordinary records of leadership in this country, including our past presidents, President Carter and Clinton, as well as Vice President Quayle. Did I miss anybody? And Vice President Gore, right in front of me. And Vice President Mondale. See, this is what happens when you start. But I think the depth of the moment is expressed by the people beyond these halls. Millions of people who over the last 3-4 days and tens of millions more over the last 2 years have participated in the very essence of our democracy. It's not just their size, but it's their intensity and their engagement. What's happening today is not about me. It is about the American people. They understand that we have arrived at a moment of great challenge for our nation, a time of peril, but also extraordinary promise. And by being here today and by participating in innumerable ways across cities and small towns and suburbs all across the country, they are demonstrating their readiness to answer history's call and to step up and give back and take responsibility for serving the common purpose of remaking our nation. The American people have come together across races and regions and stations. Now we have to do the same. Now it falls to us, the people's representatives, to give our fullest measure of devotion to the cause of freedom and liberty and justice, decency, and dignity in our chambers should reflect what we know are in the hearts of the American people. And so I'd like to all of us to rededicate ourselves to fulfilling the sacred charge the American people have given to us. I'd like all of us to come together with a sense of purpose and civility and urgency. It doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything. And I assure you our administration will make mistakes. But what the American people, I think, do expect from us now is a sense not of simply our trying to advance our own aims, but trying to advance theirs. And I'm confident we can do so. Thank you all for this great honor, and I look forward to working with you in the years to come.
President Obama speaking in Statuary Hall at a luncheon following his inauguration earlier today. NPR's David Wellna is with us now from the Capitol with some sad news. David?
Yes, Neil. During this luncheon where we just heard the new president speaking, Senator Ted Kennedy was taken away by paramedics after he collapsed at the luncheon. Senator Kennedy was diagnosed with a brain tumor last year. He was operated on. He was away from the Senate for the second half of last year, and he had come back, and he had seemed to be quite hearty. I saw him earlier before they began their lunch visiting with Senator Robert Byrd, who was alongside him in a wheelchair, and he greeted President Obama. He looked quite hale at that point, but when President Obama rose to greet the crowd at the lunch, he said, "I know that there's concern outside the room being expressed about Teddy." It's clear he was talking about Teddy Kennedy. He called him a warrior for justice, and he said he would be lying if he did not say that right now a part of me is with him, and that's true for all of us. This is a joyous time, but also a sobering time. My prayers are with him and Vicky.
David, thank you very much. And, of course, we'll bring you up to date on Senator Kennedy's condition as we learn more details. There were some who were surprised that Senator Kennedy was able to speak at the Democratic National Convention, more surprised that he was able to keep the promise he made then to be with Barack Obama as he was elected and sworn in as the 44th President of the United States. Stay tuned to NPR News for the latest on that story and for more on the inauguration earlier today of President Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States. Our thanks to NPR political editor Ken Rudin, who was with us here in the studio. Stay with us. Special coverage continues. This is NPR News.